Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man who has uncommon intelligence, who brings it to bear on matters involving the war for the free world, among other things, is our first guest, a regular here, I'm pleased to say, on Mondays at Secure Freedom Radio. He is William Walton, a former highly successful financier on Wall Street who has now turned his considerable energies to public policy and is doing so on his own televised podcast, The Bill Walton Show, as well as at the Council for National Policy, of which he is the president's great friend and always welcome colleague here at Secure Freedom Radio. Bill, thanks for taking a few minutes for us.
Well, hello.
Let me ask you, Bill, you've studied closely the various challenges this country is facing from the Chinese Communist Party. And there's an important meeting taking place this week with the Chinese, as well as a number that have begun actually last Friday with a so-called Quad meeting that Joe Biden himself participated in virtually with his counterparts from India, Australia, and Japan. What do you think the Chinese are making of the kinds of signals that are being sent by the Biden administration, notably at the Quad meeting, but more generally as well?
Well, they're delighted. They, as you and I have talked about, they have a grand strategy. It's been going on now for decades, for dominance certainly in the Pacific area, and I think their ambitions extend significantly beyond that. And the Quad meeting, they get together and they talk about the environment and they talk about a couple of small trade issues, and they're really ignoring the larger threat that that China poses. It's as if we've learned nothing in the last 4 years of the rather confrontational mode that Trump was in with regard to China, which was the right one. Now we've got an administration that wants to make environmental policy, the climate change crisis, so-called, number one issue in our foreign policy. And as I've said, I think we're naive in the extreme if we think that's the biggest issue. China is.
In fairness, they did spend time evidently trying to think about the biological warfare attack that the Chinese Communist Party unleashed on us. Whether it was by design or not is still to be determined. But the COVID, or I think better yet, the Chinese Communist Party virus, was something that they addressed. But it seems as though it was without regard to the provenance of this or what it portends that the Chinese did this to us.
Well, again, the current administration is attempting to gloss over some of the really ugly truths about the virus, about China, and about the real threats that loom. Frank, you and I have talked about it. China's engaged in their three warfare, four warfare, five warfare strategies for decades, and it's economic,
unrestricted warfare,
unrestricted in all dimensions, including social policy. And we're getting back into the habit of having these international confabs where we want to go and be liked by our international friends. And I'd say certainly the Japan and Australia and India are our friends, and we do have common interests. But unless we wake up to the real threats, the larger threats, it's just going to be nothing other than a nice meeting in a nice hotel and get on your carbon-consuming jets and fly off.
Or even skip the hotels. Just do it virtually. But, Bill, let me ask you this.
That's right. This one was virtual.
The Quad was virtual, yeah. I think the cabinet guys are heading off to have meetings in nice hotels, but your point is well taken, Bill. And most especially, I fear that the signal that will be sent here of a lack of seriousness and, more to the point, a lack of resolve in terms of countering the Chinese will simply reinforce their belief that they can have their way with us. And that's already a problem, isn't it? When you look at the extent to which they doubtless believe they have now in Washington a team very much to their liking, a team they know well, a team that they have either actually compromised or at the very least are calibrated on and know that they will not be resisting China.
Well, I think they know. You know, we've become a silly country. I did an episode entitled "China's Ruled by Engineers, United States is Ruled by Lawyers. What could possibly go wrong?" Well, if you look at the educational backgrounds of the last three premiers, they're all majoring in engineering, which is a mental discipline that thinks long term and structurally. And we have our lawyers, and our lawyers in the States now talk about an unserious country. We're in the process of dismantling free and fair elections with what's going on with the HR1, now S1 bill, which would essentially make federal law all the bad stuff that happened in the 2020 election. I think we know there's always been fraud, but right now they're writing fraud into the election laws. So the Chinese are looking at that, and they're looking at the obsessions that the administration has about climate, and they're delighted because they're playing chess and we're playing checkers.
More to the point, if the effect of that statute were to become law, HR1, is to lock in permanently the kind of people that they like dealing with, their delight must be all the more intense. It's the kind of election that they favor, actually, in their own country, and it's going to produce the sort of desired results.
It would be an election that they're very familiar with. Maybe one party. One permanent governing party. And that party would not be us.
Bill, to this point, one of the issues with respect to the future prospects of that very dangerous piece of legislation, the so-called For the People Act, but it's actually For the Democratic Party, it seems to hinge on whether the legislative filibuster is going to be maintained. As a leader of the conservative movement, I know that our team has grave concerns about this. What do you think are the prospects that will go over the side in order to get this legislation done?
Well, we just don't know, because it so hinges on what's in the minds of just a few people. And it depends on the Democrats' calculation about whether it's worth it long term to get rid of the filibuster. Now, the filibuster forces one side to have 60 votes to get this law passed into effect. They don't have 60 votes,
which is unlikely. Yeah,
but if they can make it a simple majority with Kamala Harris presiding with the tie-breaking vote, they could win. So it hinges on what's in the mind of Joe Manchin, West Virginia. He always toys with the Republicans, saying, well, if you do this, that, I'll vote with you. But he never has. And so we're left with the free and fair elections really in the hands of 10, 12 people in the Senate, and what's in the calculations of Chuck Schumer. I've talked to dozens of people, and everybody knows that it's a big threat to free and fair elections, but I don't think we exactly know how this is going to play out. So, we've got to weigh in loudly.
Yeah, we've got to scoot. But Bill Walton, thank you for your time today. And I know you'll be watching this piece of legislation closely, as will we. I look forward to talking with you about it next week and hopefully celebrating its demise. But we'll see. Bill, thank you for your time. Talk to you soon.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. I'm very pleased to say we're joined by one of my colleagues at the Center for Security Policy. Kyle Scheidler is the director and senior analyst for the Center for Homeland Security and Counterterrorism. He has been widely published in various outlets, including The Federalist, The Hill, FoxNews.com, and the Claremont Review of Books. You often see him appearing on television as well, and Fox News, Newsmax, One America News, and so on. It's always good to have him with us for his insights into the challenge we're facing, particularly from what I think of as the enemy within. Kyle, it's good to have you with us. Welcome.
Thank you, Frank. It's always good to be here.
Let me ask you about sort of a status report. We haven't talked in a while, and it seems as though, particularly in the wake of the anniversary of George Floyd's death and the trial of a former police officer charged with his murder, that Black Lives Matter and the organization and Antifa seem to be spinning up for more of the kind of violence and mayhem that they unleashed on us last summer. What are your thoughts about what's in the offing here, as well as what we're actually witnessing at the moment from these characters?
Sure. Well, the dirty little secret here is that in reality, despite the fact that the media essentially stopped covering it, Antifa and their allies never stopped acting. They continued their violent riots, protests, targeting of federal buildings all throughout the Pacific Northwest, and really all throughout the West Coast, all the way from Seattle and Portland all the way down to Los Angeles. Pretty active there, and active in a number of other cities and places as well. So this notion that things somehow quieted down did not occur. And that's had a cost, because what we saw recently was the Biden administration pulled some of the security around that federal courthouse in Portland. They removed some of the barriers that had been installed to protect it. And that very night, Antifa came in, smashed windows, accosted security guards. One of them was forced to draw a weapon to defend himself. So this notion that things calmed down or stopped in areas where Antifa is active is simply untrue. They've remained active the entire time.
And when you say active, you mean engaged in actual violence, not simply peaceful demonstrations, as we're endlessly told. And as I understand it, they actually set fire to part of the federal courthouse in the recent past. Is that right? In the past couple of days?
Routinely, they do that. Yes, that is true. And absolutely. I mean, it's important to note that their behavior does not include violence, but extends beyond violence to a wide array of activities, including what we would think of as common political activities, common recruiting of cadres, raising of funds. They're engaging in these activities all the time in order to support and carry out their violent activities that we see on a nightly basis in places like Portland.
There has been little reporting on this, as you say, Kyle. What's up with that? Is this an effort by the press to sort of protect these folks out of the sort of sympathy that they demonstrated for them in last summer's rioting? Or is it just that they're so preoccupied with, what's going on with the royals that they just don't have time to talk about what people are doing in our own cities that involves, you know, destruction of property and other threats to the communities?
I would say it's primarily two things, Frank. One is, at the local level, you have either a high degree of journalist intimidation. Antifa groups aggressively intimidate journalists, aggressively target any journalist that covers them in a way that they don't appreciate. And then you also have a high number of journalists, especially independent journalists, far left journalists, media and online outlets that are essentially pro-Antifa, if not actually engaged with Antifa in some cases. So a lot of the times the coverage you're seeing about Antifa is coming from people who are objectively pro-Antifa, sometimes even explicitly pro-Antifa. So that's important to know as well. As for the larger media, the national media, I think you're right. They simply don't care to highlight this issue anymore. It was of value to them before the election, where they wanted to create trauma and disturbance around President Trump and how he was handling the country. Now that he's no longer in office, they have no interest in covering it at all.
Kyle, the trouble is that there is a certain attention to some aspects of this turbulence, but it seems wildly disproportionate to the attention that has been paid of late to what went on the 6th of January on Capitol Hill. The former, namely the Antifa stuff, is getting mostly lowballed or not attended to at all. But there's been this intense reporting on and really weaponization of that. And our colleague Mike Waller at the Center for Security Policy wrote about his own experiences that day. Senator Ron Johnson of Wisconsin picked up on his report in a hearing a couple of weeks ago, and there's been no end of vitriol heaped on both of those men, particularly Senator Johnson, for having the temerity to say, well, actually, maybe this isn't the way it's been reported to us, i.e. that it was all a violent mob inspired or incited by Donald Trump to have an insurrection that would overthrow the government of the United States. Walk us through what actually Mike Waller and Senator Johnson have been saying and the response to their analysis of the situation as opposed to what we've been seeing in the media.
Sure. Well, my colleague, Mike Waller, who's a trained observer of these sorts of protests going well back in his career, was personally sort of at the protest, just observing what was going on. And he identified a number of groups, didn't ascribe to them any particular motivation per se, didn't allege they were part of any group or side, but he observed their behavior. And he noted that there were a number of different groups, some specifically engaging in violence, according to what appeared to him to be a pre-planned course of action. Then he saw a number of people that he called provocateurs who were deliberately attempting to guide people into the Capitol and stir up the crowd. He identified a number of individuals that he perceived to be leftists disguised as MAGA people. There's been a lot of hay made by the mainstream media that there were no members of Antifa, there were no far-left counter-protesters present. And while the numbers do not appear to be large, to say that it did not exist is clearly pretty false. You know, we have a couple of specific cases that we do know individuals were present. So to say that it's not true at all is simply false. And so Mike Waller walked people through what he saw in an article for our website, and it was later republished at The Federalist. And Senator Johnson picked this up and simply read it into the record to say, here's an eyewitness account of what happened based on somebody who appears to know what they're talking about, which, of course, Mike does.
And this was in the course of a hearing with some of the Capitol Police and other security officials responsible for this investigation, Rundchen, right?
That's right. Several of whom confirmed what Mike had seen. The response from the left and the mainstream media was immediate. You know, New York Times pieces, outrage, targeting Johnson for having the temerity to question what their narrative was, which is that, you know, as you said, it was a lunatic, spontaneous mob generated up by the president himself, now former President Trump. So they did not like the narrative being questioned.
Actually, some of the theory was that it wasn't so spontaneous, Kyle. It was that Donald Trump had been inciting these people for months with his, you know, big lie, false narratives.
Yeah, and you've seen other, fraud. You know, crazy theories that it was deliberately orchestrated by the Trump White House in sort of an explicit way. If you head to some of the fever swamps of the internet, you can see some of that emanating from the left as well. So it's not the reality is there's still a real struggle over how the issue of January 6th is going to be understood who participated, what actually happened. And there's not a lot of motivation by some in our media to try to get the story right or account for what people saw and what actually happened.
Yeah, that's being charitable. I think the interest is in actually perpetuating some of the prevarication, shall we say, that has taken place here and the false narrative that's really been propounded. Hey, Kyle, I would love to carry you over, if I could, for another block and talk with you about the jihadists' reappearance in all of this. We're now seeing members of the Muslim Brotherhood front organizations prominently featured in some of the apparent preparations for response to the George Floyd trial outcomes, and I'd be very keen to get your sense of where they are and what they're up to as well. Is that possible?
Sure, I can do that.
Wonderful. Okay, Grant. We'll be right back with much more with Kyle Scheidler of the Center for Security Policy on what Antifa is doing, yes, but also what the Muslim Brotherhood's role may be in its activities. That and more right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. We're visiting for an extended interview, I'm pleased to say, with Kyle Scheidler, a man who has really developed a reputation as a go-to resource on matters involving our homeland security. He's never taken his eye off the ball of the Muslim Brotherhood. There is a report about a mutual aid pact in Texas that sort of brings that to the fore. Talk about that, if you would.
Sure. So we recently did a report at the center on some interesting developments out of Texas. Texas suffered through that severe ice storm, that millions of people lost power. Really bad situation. And what I saw popping up was a series of media reports touting what they called mutual aid groups that were moving in to provide supplies, provide hotel stays, provide funds for people who were suffering during the Texas ice storm. All that really sounds good. It sounds like neighbors helping neighbors, which is a long American tradition. The problem is it's not true. Mutual aid is a specific term used by anarcho-communist groups like Antifa that use it to support their broader efforts. So they go out into the community, they provide goods, they provide aid, they provide propaganda, and they try to recruit the cadre to help them. And so what I saw was you had major media outlets like Rolling Stone, perpetuating this list of mutual aid groups that included some really radical groups, groups like a local John Brown Gun Club. John Brown Gun Club is an armed Antifa group. They've had members engage in battles with ICE. One of their members, William von Sprossen, attacked an ICE facility with Molotov cocktails and a rifle and was shot dead. So they're a very extreme group. And they were out there in Texas during these ice storms, literally distributing packages with their logo on stickers on every blanket, in the same way you would see Hezbollah or Hamas do, the same way you would see the Mexican cartels engage in this sort of propaganda by aid. And so in the report, we talk a little bit about how this process works, some of the risks we see coming out of it. We make a few recommendations for local officials and law enforcement for dealing with these challenges. And I think we're going to see them more in the future. And then building out of that, you then have a number of larger national groups like the Sunrise Movement, which is a large environmentalist organization that has links to Antifa, and the Democratic Socialists of America, which then provide national level cover for that campaign. They push it out into the media. It raises a lot of money. They raised hundreds of thousands of dollars in this campaign. And so I'm concerned that people in the local law enforcement and local officials aren't ready for what they're going to see down the line as these organizations grow respect, they grow capability during what's a peaceful process, but then later on, you know, develops their capabilities for violence and for trouble.
This practice of violent groups, including Hamas and Hezbollah, using the sort of false flag of humanitarian good works to both recruit and to confuse others about their true purpose. Is what you're seeing and describing here essentially an application of that, both by groups on the left as well as the Islamists inside the United States at the moment?
Well, as you know, Frank, one of the major arguments that the center has made for a long time is that we have to have a much broader view in our counterterrorism approach. And that's why we've focused on groups like the Muslim Brotherhood and like some of these other organizations that engage in the full panoply of activities. They're not just about violence, although they are violent in some cases. They are primarily about fundraising. They're primarily about propaganda. They're primarily about recruitment. They're primarily about shadow governance, right? The end point of terrorism is to achieve political power. And that is true whether you're Antifa or whether you're Hamas. The end goal is political power. And so if we don't understand the broader context here, we miss out. We allow these guys to grow and expand without being properly identified. And so that's one of the major challenges that we have is retaking that understanding of what terrorism and it really is that much of our U.S. government has lost.
One of the concerns is that worse than just sort of our tendency to ignore these things is we've been actively disinformed about a lot of it. Notably in the Obama years, when you had at the Department of Homeland Security in its advisory committee, Muslim Brotherhood members who it seems were instrumental in helping, you know, deflect attention from the sorts of people they're associated with, jihadists, onto this so-called violent extremism, which has now again reared its head in the post-January 6th moment to impugn a whole lot of people who have been described in the past as, you know, supporters of the Constitution or gun rights or veterans or right to life folks, conservatives, now Trump supporters, to essentially, it seems, say that's the real threat. Look over there, folks.
Yeah, I mean, that's part of what's so fascinating about, terrifying and fascinating about the time we live in, Frank, is that, you know, things that you and I had warned of 10 years ago, we're now seeing the outcome of. We said, you know, if you go down the road of accepting this countering violent extremism narrative as an approach to Homeland Security and counterterrorism, you're going to end up with a situation where the real terrorists aren't that bad and people who aren't actually terrorists are being treated like terrorists. We said that explicitly, and that is where we are now today. And we have a long track record, and we explain in great detail how that process was done gradually over a period of time, in ways that normalized and tolerated behavior like some of that terror financing and propagandizing that I mentioned, accepted some of these groups like the Muslim Brotherhood into the fold, in order to, you know, achieve some political outcome, whether it was building, you know, relationships with the Muslim community, not all of whom accept the Brotherhood as leadership, but that was the approach that was taken, was that the Brotherhood and their related groups would provide that political voting block. And then, you know, the approach that said, you know, on the other hand, you know, this is, you know, so on the one hand, you have situations like Nidal Hassan, the Fort Hood shooter, which the Army describes as workplace violence. And then on the other hand, you now have this situation where there's a witch hunt for, you know, for military members who may have put something, you know, conservative, something pro-Second Amendment up on their social media.
Let alone pro-Trump.
It's a total inversion of what we're supposed to be doing with counterterrorism, and it makes the country less safe and it makes us less free. And those are two things that we have to reverse.
And the thing that's worrying about it is that we have seen, as we've talked about on this program from time to time with Robert Spencer, Kyle, it seems, a sort of reprise of the kind of penetration of the administration that took place during the Obama-Biden years in the Biden administration, in part because of the Muslim Brotherhood front group's active involvement in its campaign and certain commitments that were elicited from the then presidential candidate, Joe Biden, and his vice presidential running mate, Kamala Harris, from such groups for their support, including promises to place people in every agency of the government. And there's one character that I'm particularly concerned about by the name of Mehar Bitar at the National Security Council, who's now at the nexus of intelligence and national security policy there, amazingly, as part of, it seems, this kind of commitment to put such people in senior positions. Not that he's necessarily a Muslim brother, but he certainly's got affinities for the radical Palestinian cause, which most on the Brotherhood side endorse as well.
Yeah, I mean, we saw early on in the Biden campaign, Brotherhood groups made a strong effort to reach out, and that outreach was accepted with open arms. The Biden administration, you know,
the Biden
a lot
campaign.
A lot of holdovers from the Obama camp and days where these relationships were strong. We saw early promises to end the so-called Muslim ban, which of course was not a Muslim ban. It was a vetting immigration visa issue, but it was their major issue. It was their top question, and Biden was very aggressive on it. And very early, you know, in taking office, he very quickly reversed that Trump policy, as he had promised them that he would do. And so, you know, there absolutely that's a concern. You know, we see things like. So that's on the domestic side. And then on the foreign side, we see things like, you know, reversing the terrorism designation of the Houthi rebels on the foreign side.
SOP to Iran.
Right. And it's the exact same kind of stuff that we saw out of the Obama administration back in the day. So I'm definitely concerned that we're going back to square one with the Biden administration. And you mentioned this fellow, Bitar. And what I think is so interesting about that case is he really sits at the nexus of this red-green axis that you mentioned, because he is a strong supporter of BDS. That's boycott, divestment, and sanctions. That's a movement that is directly led by various Palestinian terror groups out of the territories, but then engages in a propaganda campaign across the world and very strongly in the U.S. on college campuses. And it's where a lot of these linkages between the hard far left and the Islamist types come in. And so that's the kind of thing that is very worrisome to me.
I appreciate so much your close scrutiny to all of these matters, Kyle, and you're sharing them with us from time to time. I hope you'll come back to us again very soon. Thank you for your time today. Next up, we'll speak with John Rossomondo, another of our colleagues at the Center for Security Policy, about what the Biden administration is doing to the U.S. military. It's a wrecking operation. Stay tuned.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back, and a special welcome to one of my other colleagues at the Center for Security Policy, John Rossomondo, who is a senior analyst for defense policy. He has a long and storied background of investigative reporting and analysis, notably at the Investigative Project on Terrorism, but also as a prize-winning editor at The Bulletin, a newspaper in Philadelphia. John, it's good to have you back. Welcome.
Thanks a lot, Frank. It's great to be back, and I look forward to talking with you a bit about the military and where we're heading.
Yeah, that's the topic du jour, I think. It should be, at least. It seems as though the U.S. military at the moment, John, is, as it has often been under Democratic administrations, under assault. There are lots of different manifestations of this, but maybe we could start with the whole idea that Lloyd Austin, the new Secretary of Defense, and the Biden White House have promulgated, namely that there are lots of people in the military that are, well, of uncertain loyalty, it seems they feel, and are in need of being rooted out, purged, if you will. Talk a little bit about that.
Well, right now we're facing, in the wake of the January 6th attack on the Capitol, a wholesale effort by Lloyd Austin and the Biden administration to purge anyone who doesn't hold up to their politically correct agenda on diversity. We have the promotion of Ibram Kendi's book on quote-unquote anti-racism, which is just Marxist race theory in the Navy. You have the push for against Tucker Carlson because he dared say that it wasn't a good idea to put women in airplanes who were very pregnant. That's been very un-PC for this crowd. The military should be about killing people and breaking things, not about satisfying social agendas.
So satisfying social agendas and really being subjected to those social agendas with social engineering, it seems. And Tucker got into it over this question of maternity flight suits, as you say. But he was really, I think, touching on a much bigger problem, and that is that readiness seems no longer to be the preeminent concern of those in the uniform. They are now being trained in various forms of diversity sensitivity and accommodating transgender individuals and getting women into combat positions and so on. And John, I mean, you've got your finger on the pulse of what's going on at the Pentagon. How is this all being received by and how is it affecting the morale and, yes, the readiness of our military at the moment, do you think?
I would think that there are a lot, hundreds of thousands of people in the military who are fed up with having this agenda pushed from the top. I mean, unfortunately, President Trump didn't focus on purging the enemy from within. During President Trump's administration, you still had diversity as being pushed at the top, like the height of the Black Lives Matter riots. The Army was pushing pro-BLM type slogans and so forth. I mean, we have war games that show that the Chinese would absolutely dominate us in a war. I mean, why are we focusing on social engineering and destroying the last remaining viable institution in the in America?
Yeah, well, and that seems to me to be precisely the mission at the moment, is to take it out, as they have done each of the previous institutional assaults in the so-called cultural, Marxist agenda of the march through the institutions. John, this is all happening, as you say, at a time when we are facing real and growing threats, notably, but not exclusively, from the Chinese Communist Party and its military. You've written recently about Taiwan, and in particular, the fact that the Biden administration is now seemingly determined to withhold some of the self-defense material, including Harpoon missiles that had been pledged to them by the previous administration. What are the effects of that on perhaps increasing the prospect of China's aggression towards the island of Taiwan?
Well, I can say one thing, Frank, that the lack of equal and opposite pressure being pushed in the direction of Beijing sends the message to them that they can do what they want. And they've just surpassed the United States, now have the largest Navy in the world. They have constant flights into Taiwanese airspace. It's taxing their ability to resist. And the last administration had pledged 400 Harpoon missiles to Taiwan by 2024. Now, inexplicably, maybe it's related to Boeing or whichever, has pushed that out into 2025. I received a comment on LinkedIn from somebody from the Pacific Fleet trying to tell me, oh, this has nothing to do with, politics. But everything that the Democrats do is politics.
Sure seems that way. And this can only be taken by the Chinese Communist Party as a further indication that, as we've been talking about throughout the show, the Biden administration is going to be submissive to it. And I fear that that can only translate into more aggressive behavior yet. It's not just the Chinese that we have to worry about, though, John. You're also tracking what the Russians are doing, what the Iranians are doing, the North Koreans, for that matter. There is a lot of appetite, it seems, for behavior that would be very detrimental to our vital interests. And this would be a bad time, it seems, to be weakening our military, demoralizing it. And John, one of the other things that I think is often overlooked is our military is an all-volunteer one. And if you treat people badly for serving, for trying to, help defend the rest of us, you're likely to find that having an impact on people willing to serve. No?
Definitely. If you end up pushing quotas and other sorts of social programs that run against people's deeply held beliefs, you're going to have a retention problem. You're going to end up furthering the hollowing out of our military. I mean, all we need to do is look at the consequence of 20 years of constant war. Our entire military structure is worn out. Our weapons are worn out. Meanwhile, the Chinese and Russians have managed to take advantage of our distraction by modernizing their military. 20 years ago, we were the undisputed kings of the world. Now we're not. And, we had better start focusing on what's really important instead of on postmodern social engineering. Otherwise, we are going to lose and lose badly.
John, one other thing that occurred to me as I was thinking about what happened to Israel recently is the possibility that a country with coastlines like ours might find ourselves subjected to the kind of eco-terrorism that it apparently was the case that the Iranians engaged in against Israel, unloading an immense amount of oil, seemingly quite precisely targeted at the beaches of not Lebanon, not Gaza, but the beaches of Israel. Should we be concerned about that kind of threat as well as the other more prominent ones?
Well, I think that we need to be focusing on what the Chinese call unrestricted warfare. This is an This is an attack. This is a new kind of warfare where they're, engaging in eco attacks. It's a possibility. I mean, you could do that. Plus, also, I've written about the threat to the U.S. by Chinese and Russian container ship missiles that could be fired for international waters.
And those cruise missiles are for sale to anybody on the open market. The Iranians could be doing it as well. John, we have to leave it at that. That's a topic to which we will return with you soon, I hope. That's very, very much of concern. I believe these container concealed missiles are present and growing danger. Thanks for the work you're doing at this Center for Security Policy, John. Keep it up. Come back to us again soon. I hope the rest of you will do the same again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.